Gardeners and growers depend on the free labor of pollinators to produce fruits and vegetables. One of our most important pollinators, the honeybee, is in trouble worldwide. This hour, we'll talk about why. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and we'll start off the hour by talking about the plight of a great friend to horticulture, the honeybee. I'll talk with Amy Toth, an assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University. Then entomologist Laura Jesse of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at ISU will be here with an emerald ash borer update, and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and in a few minutes, entomologist Laura Jesse of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University will be here with an emerald ash borer update, and she and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will answer your questions. But to start off the hour, we're going to talk about the honeybee. Now, the fact that the honeybee is in trouble worldwide is not new news. But there are new developments in the efforts to unravel the mystery of colony collapse disorder and the disappearance of this very important pollinator. Researchers at Iowa State University have been working with the nonprofit Pollinator Partnership to find some pieces of this puzzle. Amy Toth is an assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at ISU, and she's here to help us understand the latest findings. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And of course, we've been talking about colony collapse disorder and the danger to honeybees worldwide for a number of years now. People want a simple answer to what's going on here, but we certainly haven't found that yet, right?
That's right. Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about what we do know. There are a number of different factors that we know contribute to this problem.
Yeah. So the plight of the honeybee, and actually all pollinators globally, has been happening for many decades. So pollinator populations globally have been declining noticeably since the mid-20th century. And so, as you said, none of this is new. We are gaining a more nuanced understanding of some of the factors that are contributing to these declines. Certainly, habitat loss and intensification of land use for agriculture and urbanization are main contributors, and that's probably what started a lot of these issues in the first place. But there are many other factors as well.
Well, let's talk about the recent findings out of Iowa State University, and that has been research into a particular kind of farm pesticide. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this is the work of Mary Harris, and so I am actually not the one responsible for this work, but I can try to describe it in a nutshell. So there's been a lot of concern about a group of pesticides called neonicotinoids. And these are widely used as seed treatments for planting corn. And during planting time, there's a lot of dust that's generated, and the neonicotinoids are actually present in that dust. When that dust becomes airborne, it can come into contact with honeybees, mostly through the honeybees coming into contact with the plants that the dust falls on, foraging on those plants, feeding on the pollen and nectar and bringing that back to their hive, in which case they're actually sharing the pesticide with their hive mates, and that can have negative consequences on the bees.
And as you mentioned, Mary Harris was doing this research, and she actually found traces of these pesticides in honey.
In pollen, yes. She was looking at pollen specifically. Yeah, so from my understanding of reading her results, I haven't actually talked to her about them in great detail yet. They were looking prior to planting, and they were not finding any traces of these neonicotinoids in the pollen. And then right when planting started, they started to turn up in the pollen. So I think that answers a question about it, which is people were arguing from one side of the picture that maybe bees were really not coming into contact with these neonicotinoids because it was just in the dust. It wasn't actually being sprayed onto the plants that the bees were directly foraging on. But Mary's results show that indeed they are coming into contact with these pesticides. So it's a concern.
And these pesticides, of course, are used widely in Iowa, but they're used widely elsewhere as well.
Yes, they're very, very widespread pesticides.
Now, let's talk about the other pollinators also, because you mentioned that other pollinator populations have been declining as well for many decades.
Yes.
Are honeybees, I know that they are the pollinator that we have control over and that we can transport. We use them as tools in agriculture. Are they also the easiest pollinator to study?
They are the best studied because we actually have good numbers on their populations. So they're what we call semi-domesticated. So honeybees can live on their own, but humans put them in boxes and we can sell them and buy them and manage them in certain ways that improve their health and honey production. And so the number of honeybees has been monitored very closely in many countries for decades. Whereas if you're talking about something like butterflies or bumblebees, these are animals that are not as often monitored so closely, although this is changing now. And so I think it was just very, very clear from just looking at the number of managed honeybee hives that it declined very dramatically since the mid-20th century. And that's partly due to just people choosing not to keep bees as much, probably because it's harder to keep bees because of all these problems. But it also reflects some of the problems that honeybee health has been challenged with in the past few decades.
Well, and the fact that, people do keep bees, and many beekeepers also provide habitat for their bees or try to have places where their bees can even collect a certain kind of pollen. Mm-hmm. Does the fact that they are seriously affected by a loss of habitat, when we actually go out of our way to create habitat for them, does that tell us that other pollinators are in even more trouble?
Yeah, well, I think some beekeepers will go out of their way to put bees in an area that has a healthier habitat, for example, that would have wildflowers or a wider diversity of crops and wildflowers for the bees to forage on, try to keep them away from agricultural areas where pesticides are being heavily used. On the other hand, if you look around Iowa, there are very few of those places. And so some beekeepers simply don't have a choice. And they're putting their bees right next to monoculture, corn, and soy fields, which don't provide a lot of food for the bees. And so I think if you imagine a pollinator out there that's not a honeybee, for example, a bumblebee or a butterfly, these animals don't have as much choice. And so they would be just faced with very unfriendly habitats for pollinators. So they would be habitats that would have very little diversity for them to forage on. Some bumblebees, for example, need specific types of flowers to forage on, and they may not find those. And then, of course, there's the widespread pesticide use that certainly doesn't help the issue.
Well, now that we have a little more information about how pollinators, honeybees in particular, are coming into contact with these pesticides, that still doesn't answer the whole puzzle to what is going on. Mm-hmm. What are the other questions that are being asked right now?
Yeah, so actually the research in my laboratory, in collaboration with Brian E. Bonning and Alan Miller at Iowa State, we've been really interested in the role of two other factors that we think are extremely important. So our research has been looking at viruses. So bees have a wide variety of different viruses that can negatively affect them. And we've also been looking at nutrition. So when we talk about habitat loss and bees not finding the right flowers and enough flowers and a wider diversity of flowers to forage on, what that really boils down to is malnourished bees. So you don't have bees that have a very good baseline nutritional state. And if bees don't have a good, healthy set of foods to forage on, they're going to be more susceptible to diseases and other stresses, including pesticides. So I'm really interested in this this area of nutrition, and a lot of other people in the bee research community are also looking at it. So we're just interested in knowing, if a bee is malnourished, how does that affect its ability to withstand other types of stress?
And again, I can imagine that would have implications for other pollinators as well.
Exactly. So the honeybee is just, we can sort of look at it as a poster child for what's going on with the rest of pollinators. But certainly it's not unique to honeybees.
How close do you think we are to having definitive answers?
Well, I think what we know now that we, let's say, didn't know 10 or 15 years ago is how complex the interactions between these factors are. So we don't have a simple silver bullet. So with this colony collapse disorder that you mentioned in your introduction, that is actually a very specific set of symptoms, which involves adult honeybees disappearing from the hive, which is kind of different from other problems that bees have. Bees have many, many other parasites and pathogens. For example, parasitic mites called Varroa destructor, which are really, really a big problem for keeping bees. And so I think what we understand now is that there may be synergistic effects of these multiple factors. So, for example, you may have a bee that's nutritionally stressed, and then mites come in, and then the mites often bring a virus along with them, and then a pesticide comes in, and you have the perfect storm for a very, very sick set of honeybees.
What do you think the outlook is for this species?
Well, I think clearly numbers have been declining over the past half century. The declines have actually been worse in the past 5 to 10 years. So historically, sustainable losses for honeybee colonies were around 15%. They're on average now about twice that. And actually here in Iowa and the upper Midwest, they're even worse. So they're around 50 to 70% annually, which is, you know, you're losing more than half the bees every single year. Usually over the winter is when you see the losses. So the declines have been fluctuating in the past 5 or 10 years between bad and really bad. And so I'm not sure it's getting worse. It's certainly not getting better. So right now, it's very difficult to manage bees, and beekeepers are having a hard time making a living off of managing these bees. I think there are other pollinators potentially besides honeybees that can help with pollination of crops. So if we're worried about agricultural production, I think there may be some other alternatives to honeybees. But again, these pollinators are also going to be suffering from some of the same issues that face the honeybees. So I think right now we're at the level of just barely meeting the needs for pollination and probably not quite meeting the needs for sustaining beekeepers. And so, you know, we're at a level where it's certainly in a dire situation. And I think there are efforts certainly to improve this through plantings of native flowers, trying to treat some of the diseases more effectively. And these things hopefully will head us in the right direction to improving populations of bees.
Well, and most of us don't have the power to do very much, although you mentioned plantings of native flowers. And that's something that entomologists and many others have been encouraging us to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And also the DOT in Iowa, for example, has been not mowing roadsides. And I think that's a really excellent step in the right direction. So they've been making a concerted effort to increase the amount of roadside area that is not mowed. And things like that can really help because that's a large, potentially large tract of land that could be available to sustain pollinator populations.
I suspect this is something we will talk about again.
Yes, I think the conversation will be ongoing for quite a long time because it's a complex issue. And we need some concerted efforts to help make better solutions.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Toth is an assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University. We've been talking about the plight of the honeybee and other pollinators. In just a moment, we're going to talk about an insect that's doing quite well. That's the emerald ash borer. And, of course, we'll also be answering your questions about plants and insects. Laura Jesse, entomologist with the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, is going to be here in just a moment, along with ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to join our conversation. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, it's Horticulture Day. We've been talking about the honeybee, but now we're going to turn our conversation to an insect that is doing very well in the state of Iowa, unfortunately, and that's the emerald ash borer. Entomologist Laura Jesse of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University is here with us. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
And Richard Giron, IUCU Extension horticulturist, is here as well. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
And let's talk about that emerald ash borer. We just had news earlier this week that it has been found in Blackhawk County now. And one of the things that I'm noticing as we're finding the emerald ash borer around the state is that the areas where we're finding it are not right next to each other like we kind of expected at first, Laura.
Yes, and with emerald ash borer and, you know, some invasive insects, this is one that really hitchhikes with firewood. So humans are one of the primary ways we move it around. So that's why you kind of get this, you know, odd pattern, because it's not the insect actually moving, it's the humans moving the insect.
All right. And the other thing that has kind of surprised me about the last couple of discoveries of the emerald ash borer is that we found it in wintertime. What are we actually finding Because the ash borer is not out there working in these sub-zero temperatures.
Right, right. And so, and actually, wintertime is one of the best times to look for symptoms, because one of the signs that really is indicative of insect activity in the ash tree is woodpecker flecking on the bark. And basically, the woodpeckers just kind of fleck off the bark. And you can see up in the canopy on the branches, you know, it's kind of almost paler colored. And that's really easy, much more easy to see actually in the winter than in the summer. And so it doesn't necessarily mean emerald ash borer, but it does mean an insect is there working. And so it's a sign to check that tree more closely.
Now, this latest discovery and the one before that and the one before that, it all sort of fills me with a sense of dread and deja vu, since I watched the emerald ash borer move across the state of Michigan when I lived there. I mean, at this point, do we just assume that it's going to be everywhere in the state?
Well, we don't think, you know, currently that it is everywhere, but certainly over the next few decades, yes, everything shows us, like what you witnessed in Michigan, it moves very well and it destroys the ash trees very quickly once it's established in a community. So it's essentially kind of like, if anyone remembers, you know, Dutch elm disease, it will completely pretty much eliminate ash from our urban communities. I mean, ash will still be out there, but they'll be a very minor part of, you know, the woodland communities.
Now, in the past, when we've talked about the emerald ash borer, and I've talked to Donald Lewis about it, he has postulated that the fact that we do have so many fields of corn, so many fields of soybeans, so many places where there aren't trees close together, that may actually protect some ash trees in rural areas. Do you think that will be borne out?
Well, the insect itself can move, you know, just several miles on its own. You know, sometimes they can move further. I think it will be, they go after what's easy. I mean, if there's an ash tree right next to the ash tree you emerged from, you're not going to fly away. But I think eventually, as there's fewer and fewer ash trees and the populations of the insect are still fairly high, that they will eventually do a pretty good job of finding all the ash trees.
All right. So again, if I'm a homeowner and I have an ash tree, and now that we're finding it in so many places, what do I look for?
Right. So the big things to look for, again, this time of the year, that woodpecker flecking, and you can look that up on the internet, and there's lots of great pictures on it, and emeraldashboard.info has lots of good information there. And we look for, you know, just canopy dieback. So in the spring, as it's leafing out, we see branches dying back. And then we just, you know, then usually at that point, we look at pictures of it. And then we do a follow-up. Someone in the state with the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship or the Department of Natural Resources will, you know, will go and actually look at the tree in person to see if we can confirm emerald ash borer there or not.
And we have a number of quarantines in place now. People are not supposed to be moving firewood from places where they've found emerald ash borer. What do you think our policy should be about moving firewood?
Yes, and so there's a new quarantine in place that quarantines the entire state of Iowa. So although legally now, you know, firewood can be moved around, but what we're really focusing on is do not move firewood around. You know, burn it where you buy it. It's not only emerald ash borer, there's a number of other diseases, including Dutch elm disease, and this will not be the last insect or disease that's spread by moving wood around. So I think just it's a good policy to start to have in place, just not to be, you know, getting firewood and then driving, you know, several states away before you burn it, because the insects can certainly come out before then.
We seem to have been protected for a little while by the Mississippi River. It took a little longer for the emerald ash borer to come over from Illinois. What does this mean for states that touch Iowa?
Well, so far, you know, Nebraska and I don't believe the Dakotas, but there's been it's established in Colorado and Boulder. So it can definitely hopscotch along. So, you know, we kind of have to remember, I mean, this insect was discovered in 2002 in Michigan, so it's really only been 12 years. It seems like longer than that, but we're really kind of in our infancy of trying to deal with this insect. But unfortunately, all signs point to it is going to pretty much eliminate ash as a useful tree.
All right. Well, let's open up the phones, and we'd love to have you join our conversation. It is Horticulture Day, and we've been talking a lot about insects, so if you have insect questions, you can certainly ask those. But Richard Geron is also here to answer your plant questions. If you're planning your garden, if you have houseplant troubles, give us a call, 866-780-9100, if you're trying to figure out what you want to plant to diversify the trees in your yard, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question that was inspired by my conversation with Amy, but Laura, I think you'll be able to weigh in on it. And the question is from Grant. Many of us in rural Iowa with pollinator-friendly prairie plantings and gardens are located close to row-cropped fields. Do researchers know how far this dust from the pesticides can travel during planting season? Might pollinators on my prairie be poisoned by seed treatment dust from the cornfield right next to my property?
That's a good question. I don't believe there's good information about how far this dust may move, and certainly we're taking steps to, the farmers are taking steps to reduce this dust. But obviously it's going to depend on, wind direction and wind speed on any given day, how far it might move.
All right. So, again, not a definitive answer.
No, no.
So many questions seem to come out of this conversation.
Yes,
not
yes.
A lot of answers. It's frustrating. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 with your questions. We'll try to have more definitive answers if you ask plant questions. 866-780-9100. Dan is on the line in Quad Cities. Hello, Dan.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to say that back in the 50s and early 60s, Rachel Carson pointed out DDT was killing our eagles and was soon banned. The neonicotinoids that are out there should be banned as well. I think people should call their representatives, go online, and the chemical companies, they're going to fight back. But as a former Iowan, I think the Department of Agriculture head in Washington should lead this charge, as well as the FDA. And we need to get them gone. They're not doing us any good, and certainly not the honeybees.
Well, Dan, thank you for sharing your views with us today. And again, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Richard, I'm having a hard time thinking about spring, or maybe I'm having a hard time not thinking about spring.
It's been a long winter, I think.
And it doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon. With these very, very cold conditions that we have seen over the past few weeks, And we've seen a number of sub-zero temperatures in a row. I mean, this has been a long period of very cold. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact does that have on our outdoor plants?
Well, on a positive note, it's basically occurring in midwinter. And plants gradually harden in the fall and early winter, and they become hardier and hardier. So the temperatures have occurred at the right time of year. One problem that I might see would be, for example, in Ames, we've gotten down to minus 20 on one occasion. And when you get down to minus 20, you might see some damage or death of flower buds or certain plants. For example, on the peach tree, maybe forsythia, flowering quince, so a number of plants where if it gets cold enough, you may have very poor bloom in the spring. And then if you have some maybe marginally hardy plants, and I'm thinking of things like maybe Japanese maples and things like that, you may notice some maybe dieback next spring as they leaf out where certain branches don't, just because of the prolonged freezing temperatures.
Now, we have had a number of thaws mm-hmm. this winter, but we haven't seen prolonged periods above freezing, which is something that we have had in recent winters. I know that can really wreak havoc
with
a lot of plants. So is that a big plus side that we haven't had a lot of those up and downs and our plants haven't been getting confused?
Actually, yes, because plants have to be exposed to a certain amount of chilling, but those chilling temperatures are above basically freezing from 32 to 45 degrees. And so woody plants have to be exposed to a certain amount of that before they can break bud and actually leaf out. And since it's been so cold, they haven't been accumulating those chilling units. And so it's very unlikely they're going to leaf out early this spring just because of the cold winter.
All right, so that's good news.
That's good.
I also, we talked a lot last year about all of these arborvitae that we saw dying off. It was sort of the combination of a number of factors, including the drought. I worry about arborvitae with another drought this past summer and then these very cold temperatures, because a lot of the plants that we, or the trees like those that we plant in our yards, are sort of marginally
right.
They don't tolerate the cold as well as some of our native plants.
It could be accumulative, because if you go back, in 2010, 2009, we had very, very wet years. We've had two dry summers in a row. Now we have this extreme cold winter. So you're putting more and more stress on that plant, and at some point you may reach a breaking point. So yes, when things do start to grow this spring, it may not have been solely the extreme cold, but maybe the weather conditions the previous 2 or 3 years.
All right. Let's get to the phones at 866-780-9100. Lena is on the line. Hi, Lena.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a gardenia plant, which a friend sent to me at the holiday times, and I followed the care and watering instructions, and I've got the plant in a south-facing window, and it's in a pot with rocks underneath, and I add water to the rock base so that the plant draws the moisture up from underneath. And when I first received the plant, there were two buds that bloomed beautifully, and slowly but steadily, the buds are dropping off.
Okay.
And a couple of the leaves have a brown discoloration. So I don't know if the cold from the window is affecting the plant. I don't know if I'm overwatering, underwatering. What's happening with my beautiful gardenia?
Well, it's basically under stress. When plants are under stress, it affects the flower buds, and they don't fully develop and they fall off. So if something environmentally is stressful, I'm not sure exactly what it would be. How long have you had the gardenia?
Since November. And also the other detail is some of the foliage is occasionally being covered with a meshy, fine-like webbing.
Hmm. I wonder if that might be spider mites.
Well,
if you're seeing some very fine webbing, they are a fairly common insect. And if you were to examine that webbing very closely, you would see very small pepper-sized little insects. And one way that you might do that would be to take a sheet of paper and hold that beneath a branch on that gardenia and shake quite vigorously. And if these are spider mites, they would fall down on the sheet of paper, and you would see them moving about. That's the best way to see them, because they're hard to see. They're very, very small. But they would be found in that webbing, kind of moving about in the webbing. And if they were present, basically what they do is they suck sap from the plant. And so if they were present in large numbers, that would definitely weaken the plant, that would stress the plant, and may cause the flower buds to fall off. So I would check that out.
Do you think that my plant will recover by spring when I can put it outside on my porch, or will time tell whether or not my plant is going to survive?
Well, I think the next few weeks are very important for it. Typically, spider mites don't kill plants, but they can stress it quite a bit. And you can use some insecticides if you need to on the spider mites, or you can just use insecticidal soap. That's probably the safest thing to use. But I would say gardenias as a houseplant, they're rather challenging, because they're not like a jade plant or a Christmas cactus. These are more demanding as far as their environment, and they can be hard to keep and actually bloom. So they can be challenging, but they can definitely go outside in the spring.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Lena, thanks a lot for your call, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Christine is on the line next in Storm Lake. Hi, Christine.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, we seem to have quite a few pine trees dying off in the Storm Lake area, and I'm wondering if there is an insect or if there's a virus or what it is that might be going on.
Well, there may be several things actually going on. We actually have pines and spruces and firs. We are seeing actually a number of different things. For example, we're seeing pine wilt on the Scotch pine. We're seeing Dothostroma and Diplodia on Austrian pine. We're seeing Rhizosphere needle cast on Colorado blue spruce. So we're seeing a number of different things, and you might look at the trees and say, well, it's just one thing. It's actually several different things on different plants. And the weather has been a factor in some of those things, too.
Is it treatable, say, on an Austrian pine, which you mentioned? Is there a spray that can be used in the spring, or
okay,
do we just give up on them?
Well, in the case of the Scotch pine and the pine wilt, there is no treatment, unfortunately. And for the last 20, 25 years, we've been losing our Scotch pine in Iowa for that reason. With Dothostroma and Diplodia, in theory, yes, you can treat with fungicides, but it's hard to do when you have a large mature tree. So it's hard to do. The same thing with Rhizosphere needle cast on a Colorado blue spruce. If it's a big tree, it's very hard to treat because you have to spray the entire tree. You have to do it twice in the spring, and you typically have to do it for 3 to 4 years in a row. So it's hard to do. In theory, you can, but it's hard to do.
All right. Christine, thank you so much for your call. And is this a situation where if she has particular trees on her property, she might want to get in touch with somebody locally who could come out and take a look?
Well, she could definitely send a sample to the Plant Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State, and they could definitely diagnose it as far as what it is.
All right. And then she'll know what she's mm-hmm. working with.
Right.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back in a moment to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and entomologist Laura Jesse. And we will be back to take more of your questions in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and entomologist Laura Jesse of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions about plants or insects at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about trimming lilac bushes. We have a row of mature lilac bushes approximately 10 feet in height. And last winter, they suffered a lot of damage with some of the heavy snows.
Okay.
And I'm wondering how far back can I trim those? And when should I do that?
Okay. What I would do, I would go out probably sometime in March, and I would select several of the largest stems, the largest ones, the biggest ones, and I would cut them off near the ground. That's going to reduce the bloom this spring, but I would do that. And then next year, I would remove maybe 3 or 4 more and basically over time get rid of most of the old growth. And in response to that pruning, you're going to get new shoots coming up from the base. And so after a few years, you're going to have a much younger, more vigorous plant. And it should look nice, too. So.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Jim. And next up is Clinton in Walters, Minnesota. Hi, Clinton.
Yes, good morning. And a very timely on the bee information, because tomorrow a group of North Iowa and Southern Minnesota beekeepers just decided to get together and answer similar questions for anybody interested in beekeeping or our diseases or that type of thing. And we're meeting, we're north of Forest City, Lake Mills, Buffalo Center area, and we're going to meet at 12 noon tomorrow at Jake's Pizza in Wells, Minnesota, to answer these very questions. Informal, no charge. Anybody interested in beekeeper up in North Central Iowa, Southern Minnesota are welcome.
All right. That's noon in Wells, Minnesota at Jake's Pizza, Clinton.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Noon at Jake's.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is a question from Randy. He wants to know, Is there a difference? And Laura, I don't know if you'll know this one or not, but is there a difference in the nutritional value between honey today and honey prior to the bee die-off?
Ooh, I don't believe that there would be any real reason for a nutritional difference in the honey. You know, the bees still pull in the pollen and the nectar, well, you know, regurgitate it and use it as food for their young. So I cannot think of any good reasons why there would be a nutritional difference in the honey now.
All right. And this one is from Dave in Ames. He wants to know, if all the ash trees disappear, then will the emerald ash borer also disappear?
Now, that's a very good question. So, and this is one of the things we want to emphasize for people is, you know, if you're planning to treat your ash trees, which is certainly an option when emerald ash borer is confirmed, you know, within 15 miles, and kind of the thinking is, oh, could we treat for, you know, 5 or 10 years and kind of wait out, you know, the insect and then stop treating? And we don't believe that that will be the case at all, that this there will be enough ash, there'll be enough woodland ash, straggler urban ash, that this insect will be here for as long as I can, you know, it will be here for a very long time. And so if you are planning to treat your ash, it's literally for the life of the tree.
If most of the ash trees do disappear and there are still ash borers around, do they have a secondary food?
No, they do not. And this is very good news and something that's been highly researched, because that's the big concern, is could they jump to a different host? And no, this insect is very much only ash trees. And when they force, you know, females with choice, you know, die or eat something besides an ash, they will die and they will not lay eggs on other species and larvae won't survive. So, yes, if all ash were gone, this insect would die out. It's just that all ash will not be gone.
All right. Ruth is on the line next from Urbandale. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I'm thinking of creating a small private garden area. It'd be kind of a contemplative type of garden area. And one of the things that we would like to do, it's next to a building, we'd like to do is build kind of a living wall using some type of shrub for a hedge. I want something, it'll be on the south side of the building. It will also have east protection. It does get some sunlight in the afternoon, but it's not full intense sun. I would like something that stays moderately narrow and that over time it can kind of keep it controlled in terms of size so that it only gets approximately 4 feet tall. I was thinking of potentially boxwoods or fine line buckthorn, and I just wanted to know what would work best here in Iowa so that I didn't have to deal with winter kill like you have with arborvitae.
Well, the boxwoods are nice plants, but they're very prone to winter injury too, so that wouldn't be high on my list. Actually, I would probably prefer arborvitae in that regard. There are a number of cultivars. Some are smaller than others. You might also consider possibly an ornamental grass. Specifically, there is a type of switchgrass, a cultivar switchgrass. It's called North Wind. Mm-hmm. It's very, very columnar, very, very upright. It is not floppy at all. And it grows about 4 to 5 feet tall.
Oh,
and I have seen it used as a screen, kind of a low screen where they don't have a lot of space and they can grow this. It might be maybe 2 feet in diameter, but it may be 4 to 5 feet tall. Looks very nice, very neat, very tidy. You would have to cut it back in the spring. But by mid-summer, it's going to be 4 to 5 feet tall.
If we wanted something that was a little more year-round in creating privacy, is there something else that you might recommend?
Well, there's not too many things that are that columnar.
Okay.
That's one of the nice things about arborvitae. There are some nice columnar cultivars on that, too. You want to make sure if you go with arborvitae that it's a very narrow variety, because there are some that get to be like 10 feet wide.
They can get huge.
Right. Some of them can, but some of them are very, very narrow. So beyond that, there's a possibility as far as maybe a holly. There are some very narrow upright hollies. They're newer cultivars that are very columnar. They're basically reserve-type hollies, so they're hardy for Iowa. I forget their name. I think one is maybe Castle Spire or something of that nature.
Okay. Well, I will do some investigate, and thank you very much for the information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Ruth.
All right.
Next up, let's go to Stephen in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Stephen.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm a beekeeper. I've been beekeeping now for 3 years, and I've kind of been struggling with this, you know, treatment-free versus treatment dilemma. And I guess the issue is I'm trying to select from all these Varroa treatments that are supposed to work, and I'm struggling with what's really, you know, is some of them actually working versus some of them not, and if there was any kind of recommendations on good Varroa mite treatments.
Oh, I would recommend you get in touch with Andy Joseph. He's the state apiarist at the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, and he would definitely be the best person to know, you know, what the options are and what has been the most successful for controlling the Varroa mites.
Ah, okay.
All right. Yep, Stephen.
I guess I should have just texted him.
Thanks a lot for your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We've got a couple of lines open for you right now. Again, 866-780-9100. Margaret is on the line next from Washington. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. I have two questions. One is about the honeybees that are disappearing so much, not only here, but they find the ones in Mexico. They're down half of what they usually are. That question is...
Are you talking about honeybees or are you talking about butterflies?
I'm sorry. I'm talking about butterflies.
Okay,
right.
Yes.
But all of these that do that kind of work, I'm wondering why as a state or as a nation we aren't doing something more to see that everyone in the state plants or makes some kind of an area for them. And then my second question is more personal. I have a Mexican lime tree that I transplanted. It's doing wonderful in my home. I get great limes. But when I transplanted it, I had brown on the leaves. So I was wondering if someone could help me with that. And I'll take my answers off the air.
All right, Margaret. Thanks for your call. Let's talk about that lime tree first.
Well, there are brown spots on the leaves or a brown dust on the leaves.
She already disappeared.
I guess I'm not sure. I would assume maybe some of the tissue is brown, which means that maybe the environment maybe is not quite sufficient or appropriate. So I would just try to give it the best care possible. I would bring it outside in the spring, probably mid to late May, basically harden it off outside for a few days in the shade, and then gradually expose it to some sunlight, and then leave it outside all summer, and then bring it outside in the fall. Inside, I would put it in a sunny window, make sure that it's watered when the soil surface becomes dry to the touch. I would fertilize it basically maybe once or twice a month in the spring and summer while it's outside, and hopefully it does improve.
All right, and we did do a program about monarch butterflies. I talked with Donald Lewis about monarch butterflies. I believe it was last spring, or maybe it was in the summertime. You could look that up on our website, and we talked about what people can do to support the monarchs that are left. I don't think anybody here can answer the question why there's not more of a movement, although I know that there are a lot of people who are very concerned.
Right. And the latest numbers from the overwintering in Mexico is it's a new record low. So things are certainly looking the monarch itself will not go extinct, but that amazing migration that we have is certainly very, very threatened.
Well, and Richard, if people want to plant milkweed this summer to do their part, where do you find milkweed to plant?
Well, it's native. You'll find it typically in roadside ditches. What you'll find if you go to the nursery would be butterfly milkweed, which is an ornamental. Very bright orange flowers and a very nice perennial.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. John is on the line from Cedar Falls. Hi, John.
Hi. I have an ash tree in my backyard, and things really sound grim with the emerald ash borer coming. I was wondering if it would just be the best thing for me to preemptively cut down that tree.
Yes, and this is a very good question. So, you know, all of us, many of us have an ash tree or two in our yard. What we're recommending now is to, you know, wait until it's been kind of confirmed in your community. But I think right now you should be considering planting another tree, getting some other
John's
things established.
Now, John's in Cedar Falls, which is in Blackhawk County.
Yes, so very close. So he's in that treatment zone, as it will, of where, you know, you can choose to treat. And so basically the cost of treatment, depending on the size of the tree, if it's a larger tree, you have to go, you need to use injections that are commercially applied. So you might consider treating, you know, several times in order to get some other trees established and growing. But yes, indeed, be planning that this tree is going to need to come out, you know, in the next, probably within a decade easily. And if you're not treating, maybe even sooner.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to have to really carefully weigh the amount of money that
yes.
it costs to cut down a tree. I wonder if that price is also going to go up as more people are going to need those services.
I don't know if I would predict it would go up or not, but, you know, for the individual, but cities and the municipalities that own thousands of ash trees, that's why this is such a huge concern, because then you start talking about millions of dollars that have to be budgeted for tree removal, and that's just hard to take.
Right. Last call of the day. Owen is on the line in Port Byron, Illinois. Hi, Owen.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I'm adding more fruit trees to my property, but I also have a lot of standing walnut timber, and I wondered if there would be any kind of conflict between the fruit trees and the walnuts. I heard there would be, but I haven't had so far.
Yeah. Well, the black walnut does produce a compound called juglone, which can affect the growth of nearby plants. But if the fruit trees are beyond the drip line of your black walnuts, that shouldn't be a problem.
Great. That's
so
all
it has
I
to be. It has to be fairly close.
All
yes.
right, Owen.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
And last question of the day. Here's an email question from Jen in Iowa City. I have a rubber tree that is not doing well. It's near a south-facing window, watered one or two times a week. It's small, only six or seven leaves. The leaves are drooping, and some are turning dark burgundy. I have some other rubber trees that are receiving the same treatment and seem to be doing well. Should I repot? Any other thoughts or suggestions?
I would try to give it good, consistent care and see if it doesn't pull out of it. When you transplant something, that does cause some additional stress. So I'd be inclined just to kind of stick to it, give it good, consistent care, see if it does pull through. If it just kind of struggles, maybe possibly in spring, I might take it outside and repot it maybe in April or May.
All right. And this is one of our last every other week Hort Days. It's hard to believe, Richard, but spring is actually coming. So we will be back
weekly
in March. just as a parting question, should we be starting to think about setting up our areas for starting seeds?
I definitely would, yes.
All right.
A few things are pretty slow growing. Things like geraniums, impatiens. They take quite a few weeks. So, yeah, you need to have the things on hand.
All right. There is hope.
Yes, hopefully.
All right, Richard, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and Laura Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Entomologist Laura Jesse of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. And now with me in the studio is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. We've had Hort Day, so now it's time for News Buzz at noon, right?
It is indeed. We take a handful of items we didn't get to earlier this week. We'll talk about the ordered reopening of the juvenile home here in Iowa. Talk with Joyce Russell about that. Also, a real warning for snowmobilers on today's program. We had a tragedy that seems to recur winters. A young man from Fonda, Iowa, was killed in a snowmobile crash. So we're going to talk with David Downing of the DNR about some snowmobile safety. And I think a lot of things that even snowmobilers don't know will be mentioned by him. A lot of other things. Bryce Miller will be talking with us. He's at the Sochi Olympics in Russia, so we'll hear from him.
Right, and he's probably watching the opening ceremonies right now.
That's right. What are they, 10 hours ahead of us? So
or
we'll
11,
be we'll
I
be
think,
watching
yeah.
them
or
tonight.
10, 10, that's right.
Is that right? Yeah. Thanks, Charity.
All right, thanks a lot, Ben Kiefer. That's coming up today at noon. News Buzz on River to River. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up on Monday's show, I'll have a conversation with author, performer, and storyteller Kevin Kling. This is Talk of Iowa.